Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 4th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman has returned to Studio A to answer your astronomy questions today. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. His new book, which will be out in February, is Earth-Shattering: Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. Always great to have Bob Berman on the program. You have a question about the cosmos? The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Neptune, comets, constellations, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Renowned astronomer Bob Berman is back in Studio A to help you ponder all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is one of the most widely read astronomers in the world. The new book, which will be out in February, is called Earth Shattering, and it is a long subtitle because Bob loves that. Bob is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Always great to have Bob Berman here. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Got to say, Bob, the advanced reading copy, the uncorrected proof of this book, looks darned interesting.
Good.
Earth-shattering, and then it goes on. Violent supernovas, galactic explosions, biological mayhem, nuclear meltdowns, and other hazards to life in our universe. And just the back, interesting. From colliding galaxies and rips in space-time to mass extinctions, nuclear meltdowns, everything in between, renowned raconteur of the cosmos, Bob Berman, takes readers on an explosive and unforgettable tour of the cataclysmic events that shape our world and universe. Well, since I have a copy in my hand here, let's talk about it for a minute before we get on to the news
of
the day.
Did it really say raconteur?
It does, man. It does. Right on the very top.
Wow. Okay.
I guess that...
Raconteur. I'm not even sure what that means exactly.
I don't know. You know, it just means you're special, Bob. And it's an interesting read already in what I was thumbing through it. What brought you to write this one?
Well, I think our culture likes drama rather than subtle things. And I've been always a little obsessed with how hydrogen bombs work and how the plague really worked. And it was fun to research this. I did not know that 23 days, like a clock, that when a ship that carried rats carrying the fleas that carried the plague would dock at a port,
yep,
it would be always 23 days later that the first people would start dying.
Amazing.
It never varied from that. And what exactly happened? I didn't know that about the percentage of people who survived and what happened. And so the different things that overcome our human race. So that's part two is Earth. Part one is things in the universe.
And you say that, a vast majority of the things that go on in space are sort of as they should be and ho-hum.
Right.
Stars are born, they live their lives, they die. But then when violence happens, it's really quite something.
Yeah, so why not tell that story? Yes.
Yes, why not?
Yeah.
Oh, me?
No. I'm saying why not as a rhetorical question.
Oh, I see.
So why not
tell that story? I haven't read the book. Wow, we're early off to a great start. All right, let's get into the news of the day with Bob Berman. Astronomers possibly finding the first moon outside of our solar system.
Well, what's funny is that you and I, in briefly discussing this ahead of time, we both agreed, okay, so they found the first moon outside the solar system, but of course there's going to be moons. We know of thousands of planets now outside of our solar system, and probably they're going to follow the same pattern our solar system has, where every planet has a moon except for Mercury and Venus. So probably most are going to have moons because moons form along with the planet from material left over from that star's birth.
And this is very far away, though. This is 8,000 light years
away.
Yeah,
far away. And it's huge. It's an odd moon. It's about the size of the planet Uranus. So it's a bigger than Jupiter. I mean, not bigger than Jupiter, but four times the size of Earth. So giant moon. And the idea is, okay, first one, but many of them are going to have it. And I guess the first of anything deserves mention. So,
well, they've now discovered and confirmed hundreds of planets.
Exactly,
so
yes.
You would figure there'd be a moon around a lot of them.
Right.
Or more than one.
Right. But, you know, especially the newer method makes it easier because the newer method, we detect the dimming of the star as the planet goes around the star. So this only works for solar systems in which the star goes around, the planet goes around the star exactly at right angles to us so that we're in line to see the planet cross the face of the star, and it ever so slightly dims it. So if there's a moon going around it that is right on the edge of its orbit, we might see sort of a double dimming as the process starts or ends. And that's how it would be detected. And that's how this was detected.
And as I understand it, this planet, Kepler-1625b, is enormous. It is a huge, huge planet. And the moon is, I guess the proportion between the planet and the moon is similar to Earth and our moon.
Yeah, we have an unusual case, of course. We have only four times the diameter of our moon. There's no other planet-moon combo in our solar system where that ratio is that big, where the planet is four times the size of the moon. The moon, that's a big moon we've got.
In reading the AP copy, I'll quote here from NASA Mission Chief Thomas Zurbuchen. He says, if confirmed, this finding could completely shake up our understanding of how moons are formed and what they can be made of. Why would that shake up our understanding?
I can't think of why it would. Maybe he's talking about because if you could have a moon the size of Uranus or Neptune, that's bigger than any moon in our solar system. And so how do you get that kind of moon? We think there's two ways you form a moon. Number one, leftover from the formation of the planet itself, in which case both of them are going to share certain properties like spin and the tilt of the axis as they spin. Or you can have captured moons, which are most of our satellites in our solar system, where passing asteroid that's just minding its own business gets pulled in by the gravity of the planet, especially if it's a massive planet like Jupiter. And then most of its moons are just pieces of debris, flotsam and jetsam, that just pass by. And then you get a different property. Then the moon doesn't have to be orbiting in the planet's equator, around the planet's equator. The tilt of the axis doesn't have to be the same. The weird thing about our moon is that it's neither. We have a moon that's unique in that it's huge, so you'd think it formed with us, but it doesn't go around our equator, which violates every other moon in the solar system, to have a giant moon that doesn't orbit the equator. That's weird. And now we've found that it has the same materials as Earth. It has the same isotopic signature.
So it came from us.
Yeah, so it came from us, but it had to have also come from something else. We think that there was a colliding body. We've even named it Theia. That a Mars-sized body that collided with Earth about 4 billion years ago, and the result of that collision threw up a bunch of debris that coalesced to form our moon. Fine. But then the moon should be made of a combination of Earth stuff and the material from this object.
Yeah.
But it isn't. The moon rocks all have identical isotopes as Earth materials. It's almost like it is pieces of Earth, and that's strange. Nobody can explain that quite yet.
Very interesting. And then the other one pertaining to a planet, perhaps, and I don't know if I fully understand this. This is from our own website. Astronomers have found, way beyond the orbit of Pluto, an intriguing distant object orbiting the sun. Just a dwarf planet, a couple of hundred miles across. But some researchers think finding it increases the likelihood that there is this undiscovered giant planet in the outer reaches of our solar system. They call it Planet Nine, I guess. Why would the finding of a 200-mile-across dwarf planet, of which there are many, right, in the Kuiper Belt?
That's right.
Why would this one lead us to, okay, here's more evidence of a possible ninth planet?
Well, it would have to be the orbit of this one, in keeping with some of the other ones we've seen, may indicate the gravitational pull of a giant planet out there that we haven't discovered. Let's hope so, because in and of itself, you're quite right, 200 miles across. I mean, when we say dwarf planet, we could get excited. Pluto's a dwarf planet, so maybe there's others like that, and that would be that would catch our attention.
Pluto's but much bigger than that.
Pluto's 1,400 miles in diameter. This is only 200, so it's smaller than most of the satellites in our solar system.
Yeah.
It's a tenth the size of our moon. It's really a little tiny asteroid type thing, of which there are thousands in our solar system, and no reason to particularly pay attention. That would be too small to be spherical. So it would be just, say, an odd, irregular piece of space trash, just like many other objects in the solar system. No reason to give it a second thought. So because it is being given a second thought, maybe its particular orbit, which is very strange, by the way, it's way out past Pluto, but it comes in at its closest. It's very elliptical. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have anything resembling a circular orbit, very elliptical. And so perhaps this shape is dictated by a massive planet that we somehow haven't yet found, but we have named Planet Nine.
Nice name.
Yeah.
Hopefully, as it gets closer, we'll have a better name. Maybe Berman.
Nine is pretty good. You know that nine is the Hindu holy number. Did you know that?
I didn't.
Because nine always returns to itself. You know how they say that life always returns, reincarnation and all the rest? They say that nine always returns to itself. You know how?
I don't know.
Okay. Nine times, pick a number that we'll multiply nine by. Name a number from 1 to 10.
3?
Okay. Wait. 9 times 3 is?
27.
And 2 and 7 are?
Okay, 9.
And this works with anything. Try it again. Pick another number.
Oh, for Pete's sake. 4.
4 times 9?
Yeah, 36.
3 and 6?
Oh, my gosh. This is incredible. Bob Berman, you're just blowing all of our minds here. Yeah. Let's take a quick break and just take a deep breath. I think we're on to something here. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. We'll get to the calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Bob Berman is our guest. He's blowing our mind, boys and girls. Very exciting. 6 turned out to be 9. Old Jimi Hendrix song. Remember that one? No? You don't remember that? Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mike in Walden. Mike, you're on.
Hey there, fellas. How are you today?
Good.
All right. Hey, I just had a question about the composition of all the planets and all that and the solar system and then the universe. Why is everything all round? What created that to be the shape that everything
is? Yeah. Why no cube-shaped planets?
Well, that's because the sphere happens to have the smallest surface of any geometric shape. It starts with that. You'll see where I'm going to go with this. And we learned that when we were kids and we had clay. They handed us clay. We learned early on that if you could patty cake it flat, you could make a big sheet. A big, like, fried egg sheet of that clay. But if you made it into a ball between your hands, the ball would be the smallest surface. So if we were going to let it dry and then paint it, you'd need the least amount of paint if you made that into a ball than into any other shape. So the same way you have a blob of any material in space, if it's big enough, if it's massive enough, it'll have its own self-gravity that it'll start pulling itself to the smallest possible shape. And the smallest possible shape is a sphere. In other words, only a sphere has the surface closest to the center than any other shape. A cube has some points that are sticking out further from the center than other areas, and that would be pulled in until it was turned into a sphere, a ball.
So it has to be this way.
So it has to be a ball only if you have enough mass, and that's why the low-mass objects like certain asteroids and comet nuclei and things like that, they can be a regular potato shape, any odd shape if they're small. But when you get to a certain amount of mass, in fact, that was one of the earliest suggestions for how to define a planet. You have enough mass, because Pluto does have enough. You have enough mass, you're going to automatically be a ball. And that applies to stars and planets and moons, anything.
Mike, work
that's
for you.
That's terrific.
All right.
Hey, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And what is that magic number of
the amount of mass?
Yeah.
Well, I could give you the mass of Pluto, but I don't know what exactly it is. I don't, I have all these things in my head, but I don't have the minimum mass. I'll bet somebody at home.
I bet you. The number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551. I saw in the news this week, maybe earlier this week, they've landed very small rovers on an asteroid. Did you see this? I think it was on a Japanese rocket, and these little, they dropped a bouncing, sort of a hopping probe onto an asteroid. What do you learn? You can tell what an asteroid's made out of.
Yeah, that stuff is so cool. But, you know, when we talk during the breaks and stuff, you know what turns me on about discoveries, and it's not planets, it's not asteroids, it's the strange stuff.
Right.
And unfortunately, very few discoveries about that. Namely, if you'll allow me to just leap away for a second.
Okay, all right.
I know you're saying, here it goes.
Here it goes. It's
starting in the 20s when the quantum theory gang, Heisenberg and Niels Bohr and all the others, were starting to do experiments that showed that the observers' knowledge changed the results.
Yeah.
And so that was the first step towards what increasingly is looking like there is some connection between our awareness, our consciousness, and the material universe. Now, this is not yet standard science. Generally, this is kind of considered airy-fairy stuff by scientists. But there's more and more indications that the universe from the beginning, from the Big Bang, may not have been primarily a material thing. In other words, the fundamental truth of the universe being matter, atoms and molecules and rocks and stuff like that, from which came life and then consciousness, but rather consciousness may be a fundamental thing. Now, you know, I live near Woodstock, so
and it shows.
But as experiments are done, new versions done in Brazil of the double slit experiment and other ways that are indicating how this may tie together. To me, that really gets my attention, how consciousness ties in with the universe. I mean, there's a new book by Mark Grober that I think is the farthest out of all. Can I give you the premise?
Fine. I mean, all I did was ask about asteroids, but go right ahead.
I know, but
Go ahead, man.
Yeah, all right. I know. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Continue.
Okay, the idea is this. Okay, what if it's true that consciousness or awareness is fundamental and primal in the universe and that it always exists? In other words, it's eternal. Just like you, you're always conscious of something. You're always aware of something.
That's a rather large leap.
Right. Okay, so we're always aware of something. So what if awareness is a permanent state? And what if the brain's function is not to create consciousness, because no one's ever figured out how the brain could create consciousness? What if what the brain does is it focuses it, filters it, limits it in a way, so that each animal's brain has a consciousness experience that's appropriate for that organism. Cat, dog, us as humans, we have consciousness that is appropriate for us as human beings. If that's true, then the brain is not needed for consciousness. It actually kind of restricts consciousness, and that would be give you the good news that maybe upon death, when the brain dissolves, you don't lose the sense of experience or awareness, but actually maybe you're freed into the larger experiences that the mystics talk about of, cosmic consciousness. And maybe that explains why studies, you probably didn't know this, people in labs given psychedelic drugs and having these so-called mystical experiences have always been found to have reduced brain function at that time.
Huh. Interesting. All right, I withdraw the question about the asteroids. Bob Berman. So our brain is basically then a bandpass filter.
Yes.
Hey, fascinating. Let's go back to the phones and hope things improve. Ray in Massachusetts. Ray, you're on.
Yes. He had just gave an example of 9 times any number from 1 to 9.
Oh, any number. It could be millions. No, don't limit it to 1 to 9. It could be 9 times anything in the billions, and it'll still add up to 9.
Okay. What other mathematical, I call them tricks, that where could I find what do you call that in math? You know, it's not an is it an anomaly?
You know, I don't know, but having lived in India when I was a kid, being in my 20s, I noticed that all their prayer beads always have multiples of 9 on them, typically 108 or 1,008, and they repeat these things that they chant, always multiples of 9, huh. And I always wondered why that, and later on I learned it's because 9 always returns to itself, and huh. they see that, you know, the universe and life always returns to itself, so that's about as
interesting.
As deep as I can go with that.
I had a teacher who's passed away now. I'm in my 70s, but I always recall this, but I could not recall the dimensions. He took a rectangle, cut it upper right corner to lower left corner, figured out the square inches in that particular size rectangle.
Yeah.
Times 2, and it came up an inch short. But I don't recall the dimensions of the rectangle. I know there's all sorts of mathematical tricks. What would I look them up under?
Huh. Bob? Right. I don't know.
I don't know, man. Listen, I'm not sure.
I don't know either. I dug myself a hole with
you
this.
You sure did. It's your fault, Bob. hey, Ray, I'm not sure that Bob has an answer for you on that one.
Yeah, I don't.
But a great call, and thanks all the same. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Vox Pop. All right, well, what fresh hell awaits us? Bruce in Salem. Bruce, you're on.
Yes, Bob, thank you for taking my call. I'm old enough to remember the Skylab program, which came right after the Apollo program. And at the time, I remember a proposal by NASA. It didn't happen, but it was considered to do a flyby with the existing equipment, which included the Saturn V and a Skylab module, I guess, to do a flyby of the planet Venus. My question today would be, why wouldn't we regenerate that before we talked about going to Mars? It would seem to me a trip to Venus would be shorter, possibly cheaper, and we might learn a lot before we went to Mars. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yep, and there's good thinking there. Venus comes as close as 26 million miles away. Mars is 34 million, so you're talking about a significantly closer planet. The problem with that, and that was the reasoning behind the Russians. The Russia early on in the 60s into the 70s, the Russians kept going to Venus with their Venera probes. We kept going to Mars, so we each kind of staked out a different planet. The problem with Venus is that it's... I'm trying to find a synonym for hell, but it's got
Let's roll back the tape for the first 15 minutes of the program.
Yeah, I know you couldn't land on Venus.
No.
Much too cruel. But
and
you
they
could
did. One of their Veneras did land on it and lasted a matter of seconds before it got all crushed down. Because you have to picture this. Surface temperature of 850 degrees, which is hotter than our ovens.
Yep.
Oh, my.
And the pressure is 90 of our surface pressures. Now, a pressure cooker on Earth works at 2 atmospheric pressures. This is 90 atmospheric pressures and hotter than an oven. So those conditions are so... Plus, the clouds are sulfuric acid droplets. It's so inimical to life, and it's so difficult for even our equipment to survive there, that it's just the opposite of Mars, which is... You know, it gets as warm as 50 degrees. It doesn't have an atmosphere to speak of. It's only 1% as thick as ours. But you know, that's the place that people with the right shielding could be walking on. And so that's where the future lies.
All right, Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. I did see a piece in the news, I think even today, that one of the large aerospace corporations has unveiled prototype, or at least plans, for a very large lunar module, about, I think, 10 times bigger than the one that they sent in the 60s and early 70s. And this one would be housed at the, I guess, planned, or I guess it's more than planned. It's going to happen, I guess, a lunar, orbiting lunar observatory, space station, as you were, about 2020. And this thing would land there, and they could go up and down. Huh. From there. So I think the moon is the next spot once again.
Certainly easier, you know, 3 days trip instead of months of travel. And if there's somebody who's really has medical problems or needs surgical intervention, you can get somebody back from the moon quick. Whereas in these other planets, they'd probably be toast. So
right.
There's a lot of advantages.
And it's a stepping stone to Mars if you really wanted to go.
Yep.
And I think there's going to be a bit of a land rush there between the Chinese and the Russians and the U.S. I think we'll have a lot of people walking around on the moon again. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. George in Stanford. George.
Yes, hi, Bob. You and I have emailed. I wonder, you were mentioning about the nature and possible effects of consciousness on the material world, and you mentioned a book and its author. I wonder if you could just characterize Dr. Adam Lanza's biocentrist theory and his newest book, Beyond Biocentrism.
I think he can do a very good job of that.
Yeah, because I actually wrote the book, even though Lanza has his name in front of mine on the cover. I actually wrote every word. So
okay.
I could characterize it. And, well, okay, how to make it, you know, when you've written a long book, how do you, the thing is, how do you say it in 15 seconds? Because that's what we have to do here.
Oh, take a minute.
Okay, here's the idea. And, oh, I don't want to take away from Lanza because he coined biocentrism, and his idea in the first place. I would have never been even doing that book with him if it weren't for him. So let me in no way detract from his importance. The idea here is that instead of nature and our consciousness, in other words, observers' perception and stuff being separate objects, what if they're intertwined? And what we're saying is that the experiments of the last 40, 50 years, especially if you start with a double-slit experiment, which I really think everybody should look up online and see until they really understand what the double-slit experiment is telling us, what that really shows is that information in our minds changes the physical world. And so once you see that that's happened, then you can start asking, why? What's going on? How deep does this go? Is this just in some areas? Is it many areas? Is it really intertwined? Is it correlative, which is what we're saying, that the physical universe and consciousness, which is, you know, nothing mystical about consciousness. Consciousness means like we're all aware.
Right.
We smell, we see, we think, we have experiences. So that these things are not separate. Consciousness is not like an incidental thing. Oh, yeah, it just arose as part of being animals. And it's that it's essential and fundamental in the universe, and it goes together with nature. So I guess that would be the quick
thing. Okay, that was well done. George, you want to follow up?
Thank you, Bob. You did a very good job encapsulating a difficult subject. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. We talk a lot about that on this program. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Andrew in Great Barrington. Andrew, you're on. Hello.
Yeah, hi there. My question is this. If the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into? Isn't that also universe, or is that like just null void space?
Well, it's a common question, and there's an easy way to answer that. To ask that question means that you're picturing the universe as if you're looking at a balloon that's getting bigger. And it's very reasonable for you to say, here's that balloon is the universe is getting bigger. So what is that space outside of it? The reason there's no answer is because there is no position outside the universe by definition, because we define the universe as everything there is. And because that's the definition, there is no outside the universe. So you can't get that perspective. And since that perspective doesn't exist, the problem doesn't exist. Instead, we shift it. We shift it to what you can answer. And that is, here you are inside the universe asking the question about the universe getting bigger. What do you see? And this is what you see. You're on a planet on some cluster of galaxies. You're looking away and you see all other clusters of galaxies are moving away from you as if you're the center of everything. And the farther away things are, the faster they're moving. I can give you the exact rate. For every million light years further, it's moving 14 miles a second faster away from you. That's what we see. That's what everyone can picture. So the space between clusters of galaxies is increasing. That's the reality, and we can all picture it. And that's, I'm afraid that's what you have to picture. You can't do the other thing because it doesn't exist. Even though it seems like it should exist, it doesn't.
So there is no edge of the universe.
Oh, there is a definite edge to the universe, but it's sort of the different one. There's a because of this expansion, there is a distance at which things are rushing away at the speed of light. That distance is 13.8 billion light years from us. At that distance from us, things are rushing away at light speed, and therefore the light from everything from that point onward can never get here. So it means we have two universes with a sharp boundary. Everything closer than that point is within view or can someday be seen. Everything beyond that point, which might be almost every part, everything in the universe, we don't know because we have no clue because we can never, never see it, represents the real universe beyond. So we have the observable universe, or you might call it the visible universe. Then you have this boundary, and then beyond that is the meta-universe or most of the universe. In fact, recent evidence from just 3.5 years ago shows us that that area beyond is at least 10,000 times larger than what's within view.
How do they know that?
Because this team in Berkeley surveyed 900,000 galaxies that are within view. That's the only thing we can see. And they found that the topology of space up to this point shows no curving. And so that indicates that what's beyond is far, far, far more than what's between there and here.
Right.
And from there, they can imply the ratio of what's beyond to what we can see. And that ratio comes out to be, I mean, it's so large that there are some cosmologists that think that that thing beyond may be infinite.
Right. Okay. Well, we
is
have to
the universe round like the Earth is?
Is the universe round?
Well, again, we can say nothing about that thing that goes beyond, but it would be hard to picture anything that wasn't symmetrical in that way, yeah.
All right, Andrew, we have to take a break here. We're a little overdue. Our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, and we'll be back for the home stretch. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. The new book is Earth Shattering. It'll be out in February. And Little Brown is the mark. Violent supernovas, galactic explosions, biological mayhem, nuclear meltdowns, and other hazards to life in our universe. Perfect optimistic reading for your new year in 2019. All right, Bob, this one came in via email from Michael. Bob, can you talk about your enlightenment experience that you describe in your book? Did it relate at all to the non-existence of time, matter, and space?
Wow, I've never been asked that.
Oh boy,
am I even allowed to do that? I mean, that's kind of sort of mystical. That was when I was 20, and after a month or so of reading Eastern-type stuff, Zen-type stuff, it was getting me nowhere. Like I was reading that the ego doesn't really exist, time doesn't really exist, and that there's this other state where you'd see everything to be joy and bliss and no birth and death, but you have to be there. You have to experience it yourself because hearing about it doesn't help you at all. So I tried to, but you have to not be thinking. You have to have an unthinking mind.
Mission accomplished.
So I'd be sitting there trying to make myself not think, and nothing worked, nothing worked, nothing worked. It was really frustrating. I remember once I was actually shaking with the effort of trying to make my mind not
think.
And of course, nothing worked. Yeah. And then one night when I was studying for a test in college, I was in my junior year of college, suddenly something in the book, I was reading about physiology, something in this technical thing suddenly made me go, and then, boom, that began. It lasted 3 weeks. And in that 3 weeks, it was no sense of a separate Bob. It was clear that
it lasted 3 weeks.
3 weeks. And it was clear in that there was no death, no birth, no time, that the universe is perfect. And I'm saying this now as sort of a translation of it, because in the actual experience, there's no
words, right?
It's ineffable. You can't really put it in words.
But wait a minute. Now, you're 3 weeks. I mean, you have to eat and things, and that would certainly bring you back to reality.
And I even went back to school. I sat in my classes. But the difference was that I was so paying attention to as the teacher spoke, I could almost see what the professor was going to say before he saw it. I wasn't looking at the girl sitting on the next desk, and I wasn't distracted. And two teachers called me on it, one in front of the class, and one wanted to talk to me afterward and said, what happened to you? What's become of you? Because they could see I was like one-pointed, like whatever I was looking at or thinking, it was just like that. That was the only thing that was there. And it was so peaceful. It was absolute peace, absolute joy. And there was also the sense of certainty. Part of the experience is like, it feels like you're home. You haven't learned something new. It's more like you've come back home. You recognize it as, yeah, this is it. This is the truth. This is the ancient way that things are. So I'm sorry I can't put it into better words than that, but it doesn't really translate. But it did give me a lifelong kind of heads up, so that when I see nonsense, you know, there's these spiritual books where they say, oh, you can control your future. There's okay. something I can see that and say, no.
Okay.
No.
Bob Berman, what got into you today? Wow.
I mean, I didn't. I've never mentioned this on air or publicly, you know?
No cold medicine or anything? You all right? You need a coffee or something? Let's go to Kevin in Colony. Kevin, you're on.
Thank you, Ray. I had years ago one of the best teachers I ever had. I'll make this as short as possible. His name was, can I mention his name?
Why not?
His name was Dennis Millspaugh. He was an astronomy teacher at Russell Sage College, and it was the most interesting class I ever took. And one of the concepts that he talked about, and and I want to know if the technology is still the same, but he would talk about two celestial stars, whether they're planet stars or whatever, but when they got close, they perturbed one another, all right? And that was kind of the way that they could measure how close and how powerful the attraction was to them. And I was wondering, has that changed? You know, because I think of, you know, Ray and Alan, those are two big stars, and they perturb one another.
Oh, boy, do they ever. They're not big stars, but they sure do perturb each other, let me tell you. Good job, man.
Well, there are stars like that. For example, Beta Lyrae, a star very close to...
Oh, Ray, you're the best.
Oh, man.
But is that technology still in place, or is there new methodology?
No. There are things like that. They're
binary stars.
Yes.
That's what they talked about, too.
Yes, there are binary stars such as Beta Lyrae, stars that are football-shaped because they are so close to each other that they've been distorted into not being spheres anymore. They're balls, and we know this because if they go around each other and they eclipse each other, we see the light curve showing that they're not round. But there's a different shape object that's passing in front of or behind the other different shaped object. So in very, very, very closely orbiting binary star systems, we do see exactly what you're
describing. Will they eventually merge into one?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the great call. We appreciate it. Let's go over to Tim in Steventown. Tim, you're on.
Hello. I think about this often, and I'm not sure if I'm getting anywhere, but when light or electromagnetic radiation travels through space infinitely, if there was no matter, no particles at all in the space, what's the medium that it's traveling in?
Well, that was a big question going back a little over 100 years ago. That's why the Michelson-Morley experiment was set up, because how can it travel? Sound needs a medium to travel, doesn't light? But finally it was found, and Einstein really solidified this, that light is a special case that does not require a medium, that it really is only an electrical field, or think of it as an electrical wave, a pulse, and at right angles to that, it creates a magnetic pulse at right angles, and that magnetic pulse produces the next electrical pulse. So it's a series of electrical and magnetic pulses always at right angles to each other that self-propagate, and they'll self-propagate for billions of years. You're right, unless that they hit material and then they're absorbed or they're translated into heat or something else, they'll just keep going forever. So, yeah, they don't need a medium.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Nick at Nassau. Nick, you're on.
Well, thank you. My question is it possible for an actual rip or tear in space-time to occur? And if so, what kind of thing would cause that?
Well, it's a staple of science fiction, of course. And for a while, it was believed because mathematically, you could have with a very, very, very strong Black-Holian gravitational field, you could get something called an Einstein-Rosen bridge, which mm-hmm. would be a tunnel that would leave our time or leave our space and then reemerge in another part of the universe or another time.
Yeah.
And for a while, there was some fanciful thinking. Maybe very bright objects are actually black holes, material going into a black hole and then are emerging after passing through this wormhole. That was the popular name for it, for an Einstein-Rosen bridge.
Okay.
And it was thought such things, such rifts in space-time were possible. However, there's other calculations that show that any object trying to pass in that would disturb it so much that it would collapse and it couldn't really exist. In any case, none have ever been seen, observed, or experimentally shown to be real, so they remain as just theoretical possibilities.
All right. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Over to Charlie. We go to Charlie in New Paltz. Charlie, you're on.
Hey, my question is, what is the communicative link between two gravitational bodies? How can something, two objects 10 billion miles apart, get the information that they're there and attract each other?
Well, a good question. And back then, a century ago, the big debate was Einstein said that all phenomena, information of any kind, are limited to the speed of light, including gravitational information. So that
right.
if you had, let's say, two merging neutron stars or black holes causing a ripple, a gravitational ripple, that would propagate through space only at the speed of light, no faster, and which we've confirmed. For example, the LIDO experiment a year ago showed two merging black holes that required 1.8 billion years to reach our detectors here on Earth. However, it should be noted the big asterisk next to that is that quantum phenomena like entanglement, quantum tunneling, and all other quantum information where something is being transferred to something else, the information does not get limited to the speed of light. It happens instantaneously in real time, no matter what the separation. So you can have two entangled electrons billions of light years apart, and if something happens to one, let's say it's observed and it suddenly has an upspin, that one a billion light years away will in real time know this happened and have a downspin without any light speed delay of the information going from one place to another. So quantum phenomena are instantaneous. They cross the universe, which I don't have to tell you suggests all sorts of wild, even metaphysical links. Connectedness may be across the universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go as far as you want with this. Whereas things like light and gravity, which is your question that you brought up, are limited to the speed of light.
Wow. Okay. So some of this is unexplainable, what the link is. If it's happening instantaneously, there's a kind of a quantum speed of light conflict.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
All right, Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Well, how do you know that they're entangled if they're 100 billion? I mean, what makes them entangled?
If they're created together, for example, you could create two bits of light together by shooting one light wave into certain crystals like beta borate crystals, and then two photons come out, but each one has twice the wavelength or half the energy of the one that went in, so there's no violation of energy.
Okay.
And these are entangled. And so as they travel apart at the speed of light, no matter how far apart they are, each one knows what the other is doing, so that if you make an observation on one that changes it, and an observation always changes it, the other one will react in real time. Now, a lot of people didn't believe this, including Einstein, who thought, no, that can't be. That would be like spooky action at a
right.
distance. That can't be real. And it was finally nailed down only in 1997 by Nicolas Gissan in Geneva, Switzerland. That was the first experiment, and then it was confirmed by David Wineland at the National Institute of Science and Technology in 2002. I even spoke to Wineland about it afterward. And that was the first absolute nail-it-shut experiment that showed that this entanglement data, and it wasn't limited to the speed of light. That testing limit was 10,000 times faster. And recently, two years ago, a Chinese team showed that that quantum information goes at least 10,000 times faster than the speed of light.
Very interesting. All right, back to the phones and Ryan in Hudson. Ryan, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hey, good afternoon. I have just a quick comment about your trick with the number 9. I'm a math professor down at Columbia Green. The reason that 9 works is because we happen to use a base 10 number system. If humanity had evolved with 8 fingers, we'd probably use a base 8 system, and 7 would work.
I love that. That's so cool. Thank you so much.
It's always one less than whatever your base system is.
I had no idea of that. That's the best thing I've heard all day.
Absolutely.
That's so great.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Ryan.
All right, great. I had a quick question. A couple years ago, I remember being really excited seeing Felix Baumgartner's jump from the edge of space, where he took that helium balloon up
and
no more than a pressure suit just parachuted down safely to Earth.
Yeah.
Part of the reason he was doing that was to show that it could be feasible maybe from the ISS if they needed to get out of there in a hurry. How feasible would that be from something as high as the ISS? Would their velocity be too great jumping from there to use a parachute?
Yeah, the problem there, unlike that helium balloon, is you're not just being accelerated at the normal rate of Earth's gravitational acceleration, excuse me for using non-metric, but instead of 16 feet per second per second.
The
ISS has a forward motion, and we're talking about in the realm of 18,000 miles an hour. And so that becomes the problem. You're not going to lose that forward. That forward motion is far greater than your just normal gravitational acceleration. So you're going to hit the atmosphere
at this friction.
You burn
exactly.
Up.
And that's a problem.
Okay. All right, thanks so much.
Well, Ryan, thanks a lot for ending a very, very interesting edition of Vox Pop with Bob Berman today. The new book, which is out in February, it's a real, it's a feel-good book. Earth-shattering, violent supernovas, galactic explosions, biological mayhem, nuclear meltdowns, and other hazards to life in our universe. And that will be out in February of 2019. Bob Berman, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you, Ray.
That was
pleasure.
A weird one, huh? All right, let's not do it again for another month. Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company. Organic coffee in the brown paper bag, now roasted with renewable energy. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches, ColbyService.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Painter Edith Hunsberger exhibiting watercolor and acrylic paintings at Paradise City in Northampton, Massachusetts, Columbus Day weekend, booth number 935, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And HMT at the Spa Little Theater kicks off their 34th season with the musical Young Frankenstein, based on the Mel Brooks film, weekends October 13th through 28th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga State Park, homemadetheater.org. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here this afternoon. Thank you for listening and for the great questions today. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Jesse King. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, you know, it's Friday. That makes it a Food Friday. And tomorrow, it's all about apples and cider and such. Right now, stand by for news.